Jeff will have to leave, so we'd like to take a few questions for, I think this is a very important area, so we'd like to take questions from the floor. I almost think that maybe we should have changed the order a little bit and have a discussion section now before Patrick talks, if that's all right with you, because these talks are related, and so perhaps we could take questions both regarding Dr. van der Sande's talk on magnesium the talk. Are there questions from the floor? And please come to the microphone because this thing is going to be recorded, and also fill out cards. Jeff, I also wanted to, in terms of the magnesium, I guess that the question wasn't addressed as I understand it because that wasn't specified in the Kaidoki Controversies Conference. What's your take? Do you believe that there's enough evidence on magnesium to suggest that we should either give oral magnesium supplements to some patients or to go a little higher? I looked into this. The problem is everything is being standardized now, and now in the U.S., it's almost impossible to get a dialysate magnesium other than one MEQ per liter because, you know, companies don't want to do it. The LDOs don't want to mess around with different dialysate concentrations. And in a way, there's the wisdom of the herd, and we're sort of standardizing on a 1 MEQ magnesium concentration without perhaps looking into a higher level. What's your sort of take on the whole magnesium thing?
Well, my personal take is I agree with the data that was presented, that I think there's probably a substantial proportion of dialysis patients who have, if not overt hypomagnesemia, low serum magnesium. And I think that I agree with you. It would be beneficial if we could not sort of standardize everybody on the same dialysate magnesium concentration, sort of the way we I wish we had a few more options with calcium in the dialysate. But from a KDIGO perspective, I suspect, so we didn't address the question, let me be clear. We didn't evaluate any evidence review on magnesium. And if I had to guess the evidence, we would end up in a position that suggested we would have a 2D statement about dialysate magnesium simply because we don't have any evidence other than the observational data, which I agree with you is suggestive that people with higher magnesiums do better than people with lower magnesiums. And I completely agree with its effect on vascular calcification. And the only evidence we have is this little bit of evidence from the CalMag study, which is good. We probably deserve whatever the next iteration is, if we can do some randomized trials on magnesium-based binders or magnesium supplementation or changes in dialysate magnesium to some other outcome other than just serum magnesium would be really helpful.
Yeah, I was interested in that CalMag study. I don't know if you people know, there's a binder that's available in Europe that actually Fresenius was working with, which is a combination of calcium acetate and magnesium carbonate. And there was a randomized trial of this and showed that it was very effective in phosphorus lowering. And the idea was that you not only lower the total calcium dose, because both the calcium portion and the magnesium portion bind the phosphorus, but then you also have the anti-calcification antidote, mm-hmm. giving it with the poison, which is the calcium. And these people had a markedly increased serum magnesium level in their blood. And as far as when at least to my reading of the study, there were no really adverse effects.
I concur. I wish we don't have that available in the United States, and I'm not entirely sure why.
Okay. Let me go through the cards first, and then we'll ask the question. Well, go ahead, please.
Dr. van der Sande, is there a relationship between magnesium and FGF23?
It has been suggested, but I couldn't find in one of the articles I read in the last half year. Good, fine, sorry.
Yeah. Okay, let me go through the cards. First question, total calcium, free calcium, corrected calcium, which should we use?
It's more challenging than... So the current guidelines continue to use the corrected serum calcium, despite the fact that I think almost everyone agrees that total calcium is probably a better reflection of ionized calcium than albumin-corrected calcium. The problem that we face as an evidence is that almost everything we have is based on a corrected calcium information. So bottom line is that the guidelines still use corrected calcium. And we can't measure ionized calcium consistently from the dialysis unit, which is a problem. So corrected calcium is the default.
Okay, thank you. Next question. Next card says this is a little bit. I'm not 100% sure what's being aimed at here. Is KDIGO speaking with CMS? Ray, measuring targets with financial ramifications where KDIGO sees requirements inconsistent with best practices recommendations. Just in general, sort of maybe what's, you know, sometimes these KDIGO recommendations have unintended, any type of guideline recommendations have unintended consequences. I was co-chair of the adequacy group, and we were really very concerned about how these guidelines can be used to benefit patients or for ill by patients who are payers. Do you have any enlightenment on this topic?
I think the simple answer is no. I don't think KDIGO has any discussion with CMS about the implications, but I share your concern, and it may surprise everyone in the room. I've been a vocal critic of the desire by CMS to set a phosphate goal. I think that it's a perfect example of where we might create more harm than good. Achieving a particular serum phosphate and its beneficial versus harmful effects is completely dependent on how you get there rather than the target itself. And I think I continue to advocate against this notion that setting biochemical goals should be a quality measure. I think it's a dangerous thing.
Question on the indications for parathyroidectomy. And I don't know if the guidelines I can't recall if there was any change for guidelines for parathyroidectomy. What would be the indications of when to abandon medical therapy?
Yeah, so the work group did not address the indications for parathyroidectomy in our revision. There have been a number of clinical trials, all of which by their nature are non-randomized clinical trials looking at the effect of parathyroidectomy. And to be fair, there are some observational data that suggest harm with parathyroidectomy, and there are some that suggest benefit with parathyroidectomy. So, but the work group didn't specifically address this question. So right at the moment, it's the clinical judgment with regard to the indications being, you know, uncontrollable hyperparathyroidism in a patient who otherwise could receive a parathyroidectomy. There are some pretty clear data that the event itself is associated with subsequent morbidity. And I should just mention that we did recognize that etylcalcetide, we wrote these guidelines at a time when the data on etylcalcetide had been finished but not yet fully published. So etylcalcetide is briefly mentioned in the guidelines, but everyone is probably aware that is now a therapeutic option that should probably be evaluated before consideration of parathyroidectomy, if possible, and available.
There was one on ionized magnesium. I'm not sure that that's whether we should measure ionized or total magnesium.
You don't measure ionized. It's almost impossible to measure ionized magnesium. It's a very difficult technique.
And the last one I have on the cards before we go to the audience is the bone biopsy has been a barbaric procedure for the patient and clinician. Is there new technology or techniques available regarding this, and are there specific recommendations regarding what pathology labs can read biopsies? I think you've sort of talked about this a little bit, but is there any, I don't know of any alternative. Do you know of any valid clinically, what are you sort of doing?
Yeah, no, it'd be fantastic if we could spend, if there was some research related to non-invasive assessment of bone remodeling disorders, but to my knowledge, there hasn't been any advancement in that particular field, despite HRP, QCT, et cetera. We don't really, but I would disagree with the notion that bone biopsies are barbaric. They're not, and it's too bad Kevin Martin's not here. I recall not too many years ago, this is a procedure that requires sort of conscious sedation and 15 minutes, right? It's not barbaric. Tylenol treats the pain. It's maybe logistically, you know, a lot of work, but it's not barbaric. And patients generally don't, if you ask them to do two, they generally will do the second one. So I think there's a misconception about just how
And in terms of the people reading them and the expertise in the pathology labs reading them, I know in like the prostate biopsy, there was this one center that would do it all. And so what in terms of Denver, you have this one guy that reads them, I guess, right?
Yeah, it's a huge problem. It's probably the bigger problem, right, is getting somebody to read them, and I don't have an answer. I think there are very few centers in the United States that still read bone histomorphometry. From a practice or from a nephrology perspective, we're going to run out of those institutions soon. Dr. Maluka is probably the read more bone biopsies in his laboratory than anyone, I think, in the United States, and I think his lab was the one that helped KDIGO with the interpretation. There was a paper 18 months ago of a review of all of the bone biopsies that were reread by Dr. Maluka's laboratory. So his laboratory seems to be the best place in the country.
Thanks so much. Two quick questions, one's for both speakers. The dialysis patient seems to be more sensitive to hypomagnesemia. Do we have a good sense on what's the optimal range for their pre-dialysis magnesium level? Looks as though very different from normal kidney function population. That's number one. Number two, how do you assess the total body magnesium store? Is there a new advances for dialysis? At Mayo, we do occasionally magnesium loading study, and that's very cumbersome. But for the patients on dialysis, there's no way we can do it, so I wonder.
Yes, with regard to your first question, the optimal dialysis magnesium concentration, it isn't known. There are no guidelines, there are no mass balance studies. That's why we performed the cannabis via Masrawi and Peter Kutanga from RI in the first two patients. We will move forward to many other patients. FIAP made a kind of model, let's say a kind of fitting model, based on the results, so based on the albumin, pH, hematocrit, body composition. And in this first patient, he removed almost 200 milligrams of magnesium, and we used a magnesium concentration of 1 milligram per liter. But based on this model, we should have increased the magnesium concentration to 2.0 of 1.8 milligram per liter per treatment. So I think we move forward with this model. And hopefully, the coming month, when we also have the availability of higher dose magnesium concentrations, then we can make a kind of model in which we can fit perhaps every patient in whom we have a pre- and post-dialysis magnesium concentration. So what the right magnesium concentration at the moment is, I think the magnesium concentration we use at the moment are all too low.
I'd like to ask one follow-up question. There was a study out of Mayo that suggests that there was not, everyone thinks about magnesium where there's a low, it's high risk, and it sort of flattens out at the high magnesium. And then, so I was very concerned about this Mayo Clinic study that showed that in hospitalized patients, people with higher magnesium had a poor outcome. Paradoxically, that they did a lot worse, and they had poor cardiovascular outcome, and one of the interpretations, I think, that some of these people are self-medicating. I think this is a whole problem right now in the community, is a lot of people are self-medicating with the sort of therapy du jour, and it's out there at least that if you have vascular disease, a lot of people now are taking magnesium supplements. So there was perhaps some confounding by indication, and I didn't know. I always thought that being a little high in the magnesium was safe, and then I saw this study from the Mayo Clinic that concerned me. Do you have any sort of wisdom on this?
The patient population is very different. They're not on dialysis.
Right.
And it's all inpatients. So again, the concern is maybe the self-overzealous magnesium. But again, to the question, if magnesium is a major interest. Can we be more aggressive on the patient who has truly, truly needing magnesium? That's always a question.
So you're asking me, should we more aggressively treat the patients?
How can we assess the magnesium?
The only things that I read was that we only can measure total magnesium. or serum plasma magnesium. The iodized magnesium concentration is difficult to measure. It varies in patients. There are suggestions that the best measurement is magnesium meshing in the hair. That is the best measurement. But I'm not aware of any methods of measuring the exact load of magnesium in the body. Not aware of that, no.
That should be the direction, because mm-hmm. magnesium is a slow...
Sure, it is, yeah, it is. Yeah.
So if we are contemplating mm-hmm. oral magnesium supplementation,
yeah.
it's a chronic process, and we should really identify what kind of patients
sure.
we need.
Sure, I do agree. Absolutely, yeah. I do agree, yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Chan. Please.
Question. I know you're making recommendations for PTH, and now with the cinacalcet being included in the bundle, I'm afraid we're going to have more referral to parathyroidectomy. So I don't know if the group from the KDIGO recommended into one, what is the best way to proceed? And the second one is, we don't have an exact way to measuring PTH, and different labs have different values, and we know that the active PTH is not really, which is the one that counts, can be vary. Even if you have a 600, it may be totally suppressed or maybe higher. And so are there any recommendations in trying to improve the way we measure?
I'll try to answer this. There's a couple important questions you asked, and I actually appreciate the opportunity to make a comment. So as you know, the KDIGO range, recommended range for PTH in dialysis patients is 2 to 9 times the upper limit of normal for your lab. This, again, has been widely misinterpreted. And it's frustrating for those of us who spend our time crafting these guidelines to see how, despite our particular attention to single words, you know, for hours about words, it gets misconstrued. That guideline does not mean don't treat PTH until it's greater than 9 times the upper limit of normal, which is still the algorithm that I see most commonly distributed, which is begin therapy when it goes above 9 times the upper limit of normal. That is not the intent of the KDIGO guidelines. I can tell you, having been on both work groups, if somebody has progressively rising PTH within that range, it should be treated. We don't comment on the specific assay issue, purely because, not because it's not important, but because there is no additional evidence from RCTs about that could change our interpretation of which assay we should recommend or use. And so the current recommendation stays the same with this 2 to 9 times your upper limit of normal assay. There are real problems with the assay, and I should point out that the KDIGO workgroup does wholeheartedly endorse in our guideline the use of alkaline phosphatase as a contributory assessment of what's happening to bone remodeling beyond just the PTH. So when you're interpreting a PTH, it has to be done in the construct of the alkaline phosphatase, and the two of them together should help direct your therapy. It's not uncommon, as you point out, to see PTHs of theoretically 1,000, 1,200, 1,500, but an alkaline phosphatase of 60. All right, that doesn't reflect high turnover bone disease. And you certainly wouldn't institute a parathyroidectomy in that kind of patient, even though their PTH looks like it's, you know, way beyond your target. So combine use of those two tests, and I hope what you said with regard to the bundle and the effect on parathyroidectomy does not happen. I have to believe that parathyroidectomy is not a benign event in any capacity. So I hope that doesn't take place.
Okay, we have one more question. It's actually kind of close to my heart. It's looking about the interaction between phosphorus and albumin, and it says why did KDIGO not factor in phosphorus? Well, it says, as a clinician, I find myself telling my patients things like, I forgive you for your high phosphorus if you get your albumin up. I think it's a good, first of all, I think it's a misconception out there that even I had, excuse me, the phosphorus is not part of the protein. If you look at amino acids, there's almost no phosphorus there. So and the misconception is that you can't restrict phosphorus if you eat a lot of protein. So the phosphorus comes in things in foods that are high protein foods, but it's not part of the phosphorus molecule, not part of the protein molecule. So, and if you don't believe me, you can find low protein whey or low phosphorus whey or low phosphorus egg protein that has a very high biological value protein that has almost no phosphorus, has a ridiculously low amount of phosphorus. Even though in terms of how phosphorus is found in foods, it is coupled to proteins, and we talk about the phosphorus to protein ratio that varies with the different foods, and there's a difference between the animal and vegetable protein where the phosphorus is, and also in dairy products, obviously. There are definitely ways that you can get your protein without eating a lot of phosphorus. I know my kids, they have these big tubs of whey protein because they want the bodybuilding. A lot of you have teenage kids and they buy these big tubs. And you can really feed a tremendous amount of protein without phosphorus if you want to. Jeff, I don't know if you want to, I don't know if what Kay Digo said or if you have practical clinical experience in doing this.
I share your thought, and I would also encourage everyone to appreciate that our understanding of phosphate, what determines serum phosphate, it is not simply intake, absorption, excretion. We ignore a tremendously important component of transcellular shift of phosphate and the mechanisms that are responsible for that transcellular shift. It's interesting. I think that our understanding of phosphate biology is going to change dramatically over the next 18 months, all right? And I think that there was just a paper accepted, I think in one of our journals and an accompanying editorial about the important role of transcellular shifts in serum phosphate, all right? And I think that I would just encourage all of you to realize that when your patient's serum phosphate doesn't behave like you want it to, right, that doesn't mean they're either non-compliant with their diet or non-compliant with their binders, and I would not label that patient as non-compliant. And I agree with you completely that I almost never restrict protein for the sake of trying to control serum phosphate.
Good. I think this discussion part is over. I thank our speakers for a great and very practical session, and I think this is a clinical problem that we all face in our practice every day.